Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
People are very clearly more and more saying they don't want chemicals and drugs in their food system. That is so clear. It's so loud and clear. And the mainstream beef industry is still not getting that message.
Nicolette Hahn-Nyman hopes her book will show the way forward for the beef industry. Her suggestion, put as many cows on grass as possible. You'll see kale at local farmers markets this time of year. We've got a recipe where you eat it raw. California is king when it comes to growing kale, but farmers there are still struggling with the ongoing drought. Harvest Public Media looks at why Midwest farmers have not been able to pick up the slack. And Jerry and Paula Perrin became farmers after they retired. We've got a fun conversation with them today on Earth Eats. A lot happened this week in food news. Lou Ann Johnson with a rundown.
Bird flu continues to march across Midwest poultry farms. The USDA reports it has affected 174 farms in 15 states. The only solution officials have come up with as of now is to kill the chickens and turkeys, even healthy birds. That's because there's no vaccine. The death count is nearing and will soon surpass 39 million birds. Iowa is the country's largest egg-producing state, so it's been hit hardest by the outbreak. As Harvest Public Media reported this week, officials believe the virus was brought to the Midwest by migratory waterfowl. The first case of this particular strain of avian flu, H5N2, was confirmed in a backyard flock in Washington state. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has admitted that the ongoing and quick spread could be laterally spread by people. Check out our Twitter feed to read the latest updates on the bird flu outbreak. We're at Earth Eats. Some better news this week. The White House's Pollinator Health Task Force announced a plan to save honeybees and monarch butterflies. It's dubbed the National Strategy to Promote the Health of Honeybees and Other Pollinators. Outlined in the plan are ways to increase bee habitat and fund research into bee loss, such as how bees are affected by disease and pesticides. One major concern has been about neonicotinoids, a class of pesticide widely used on crops in the U.S. The White House's task force, however, did not immediately address the concern over neonics. Environmentalists were quick to criticize the president's plan, arguing it didn't limit current use of the pesticides. Target announced its food section will carry more fresh whole foods and fewer packaged processed ones. Target's chief executive, Brian Cornell, brought together some of the U.S.'s largest packaged food manufacturers to break the news. Instead of promoting sugary, fatty foods like sweetened cereal and snacks up front near the checkout lanes, Target is going to promote healthier options, like granola and yogurt. Annually, Americans spend $15 billion on food at Target stores. This could make an impact for processed food giants like Kraft, already reeling from a disappointing earnings year. There are signs Target is making the right move, at least financially. When the past quarter's earnings were released Wednesday, Target showed a 3% revenue increase and 52% increase in profits from February to May. The government's latest report on foodborne illness contains good news and bad news. The CDC tracks laboratory-confirmed infections for the most threatening foodborne diseases via its FoodNet tracking system. In the study, the agency compared infection rates from 2006 to 2008 with that of 2014. The good news is that the infection rate for the most dangerous strain of E. coli, which accounted for 6% of all the infections, dropped 32% between the two periods, an improvement that the agency attributes to better inspections in the beef industry. Salmonella, still the most common cause of food poisoning, held steady along with Listeria, but Campylobacter crept up by 13%, and Vibrio, a bacteria usually linked with eating raw oysters and seafood, shot up 52%. Vibrio can cause cholera and other infection types and accounts for an estimated 800,000 illnesses and 100 deaths per year. The agency estimates about 3,000 people die in the U.S. from foodborne illness each year. And another story about food contamination. Remember the peanut butter recall from 8 years ago? Peter Pan peanut butter tainted with salmonella made 600 people sick. This week, ConAgra Foods was fined $11.2 million for shipping those tainted products. It's the largest fine ever in a U.S. food safety case. Links to these articles are posted in the latest article on our website. Find it at eartheats.org.
And let me reiterate what Luann said earlier. Twitter is the place to hear news like this as it's breaking. You can interact with our feed at Earth Eats. Luann Johnson, thanks.
My pleasure.
California is the nation's salad bowl. It grows almost half the fruits and vegetables in the U.S., but it's also deep in drought, and on some farms, water is growing scarce. That may sound like a chance for Midwestern farmers to churn out more peppers and broccoli, but as Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media reports, it's not that simple.
Right now, things are a real mess because this is our busiest part of the year.
Andy Daniels is rushing around his 500-acre vegetable farm along the Platte River in eastern Nebraska. They're busy sprouting cabbage seeds and deciding what kinds of squash to plant. The food they grow will sell across the country, from small-town veggie stands to Walmart distribution centers.
We have broccoli, cauliflower, weeds.
For 3 years, Daniels has been watching for a business opportunity from California's drought. He's been waiting for Central Valley vegetable farms to cut back and save water.
I don't know how long they can get by. They're going to run out of that deep aquifer water.
At least that's what he's been waiting for, and he's still waiting.
People who think that they're going to make money because of California, jump on in. We'll see how long you last.
Daniel says the California drought is not the golden opportunity that it may seem, not yet. Because even in a drought, California still has big advantages over the Midwest, starting with the climate. California is a collection of microclimates. Some spots are perfect for broccoli, others for lettuce. The weather is predictable. In Nebraska, it's erratic, from summer to winter.
You know, the average in Nebraska, the average temperature may be 70 degrees. All that is the average of 120 and 20.
So the weather doesn't help. Then the next problem is infrastructure. You can't grow a field of peppers with corn machinery. You'll need a $14,000 vegetable sorter, a $400,000 cold storage house, and that's before any work gets done. Labor is Daniel's biggest expense.
I'll spend $800,000 to $1 million on labor.
That's to hire teams of migrant workers, because vegetables are picked by hand, not with combines. Even if you have a crew and the equipment, there's a learning curve. Daniels grows 20 to 30 vegetables, and each one is unique.
You're going to find God made a worm and a disease for every plant out here. I never knew there was such a thing as asparagus beetle until I raised asparagus.
Things were different 50 years ago when fruit and vegetable production was a larger part of Midwest farming. Now it's all about corn and soybeans. Dave Swenson, an ag economist at Iowa State University, says there is room to bring back fresh produce around urban areas, but not on a national industrial scale.
You're not going to plant 168 of peppers in Iowa because you don't know who's going to buy your peppers, and you don't know what kind of price you're going to get for them.
Ramping that up in the Midwest would take decades. Meanwhile, Swenson says the South is more likely to take the pressure off of California.
Many people have talked in recent weeks and months about the Mississippi Delta in that Mississippi floodplain area.
Growers in Mexico and Canada will also be in the mix, but here's where the Midwest can make a play on the drought: dairy and beef. The reason is alfalfa hay, used for livestock feed. Cattle ranchers might think about moving to greener Midwest pastures as their state grows less alfalfa to save water. Dan Putnam at the University of California, Davis, says alfalfa acres in California are headed for a record low.
What they do is they move water from one crop to another. If a grower has a tomato contract, for example, they may let an alfalfa field go dry because they just simply don't have enough water to go around the whole ranch.
But that's why Andy Daniels is still searching for a silver lining from California's drought disaster. Fruits and vegetables will be the last crops to go dry.
So where's the opportunity at? Why don't you tell me? Because I've been telling my daughter for 2 years, stick out a drought in California. It's going to change. We're going to make money.
Instead, prices for things like watermelons and cabbages went down. Daniel says he focuses on labor costs and food safety rules and new markets. California is way down the list. In fact, the next big thing for Daniel's produce isn't westward expansion. It's going local, selling more produce directly to consumers. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
More stories about America's food system at harvestpublicmedia.org. Nicolette Hahn Nyman calls herself a lifelong environmentalist. She's worked at the Waterkeeper Alliance and the National Wildlife Federation. She's also a livestock rancher. She considers her work with cows an extension of her environmentalism. Her new book, Defending Beef, explains why. In fact, that was one of the driving forces behind writing the book in the first place, to recalibrate the conversation about raising cattle.
There's a lot that's being done wrong with cattle husbandry today, both in the United States and other parts of the world. But to me, the problems are not inherent in cattle or in beef. It's really human error.
When she says she's defending beef, she's not defending conventional feedlot operations. She's talking about well-managed grass-based farms. Nyman owns BN Ranch in Northern California. The cows on her ranch are completely grass-fed.
You know, the best place for them to be is in a situation where they're outdoors and they're grazing, they're exercising, and they're eating vegetation that they themselves are harvesting through their own grazing. And what humans should be doing is to be managing those cattle as much as possible in such a way that their impact on the land is similar to how wild animals once grazed around the world.
She explains that this is actually helpful to the natural world. Cows graze the entire time they're awake. They live in densely packed herds.
The reason that that's beneficial for an ecosystem when they're well managed is because their mouths are clipping the vegetation, and that's like what we would do in our gardens with pruning. You have to prune away vegetation to keep the plant itself healthy. That stimulates that plant to grow. But even more importantly, it stimulates all of the other plants around it to be able to grow, because you're getting rid of the shade. And they actually call that the thatch. When you have grasses that grow long and they dry out and they die, or even before they die, when they grow tall, they prevent all of the other later germinating seeds from germinating and from successfully growing. That's number one. Number two, the hooves of the cattle are actually, a lot of times you hear, oh, the trampling hooves, and then it's sort of said in a negative way. Well, it's true. Again, it's the key is good management. If they're not being managed correctly, the hooves can be a negative. But a well-managed grazing operation, the hooves are essential, because they're actually pushing the seeds into the ground and they're pushing the vegetation into the soil, which is where the sort of biological action of the soil can take place. So the biological processes of recycling the nutrients that are in the plants and feeding the soil life happen better when you have that trampling of the hooves.
And then finally, there's the manure, which adds nutrients back to the soil. These three processes create a beneficial disturbance on the earth. Taking it a step further, she talks about this beneficial disturbance and how it can actually help mitigate climate change. Well-managed, grass-based cattle operations can actually help store carbon from the air in the soil.
You know, we all learned in elementary school that photosynthesis is the process where plants grow and they basically take carbon dioxide out of the air, and then they use that for their own processes. The part we didn't learn in elementary school, and actually nobody really understood until about the last 20 years, is that what then happens below ground is essential. And basically, it goes like this. The plants bring the carbon from the air into themselves through photosynthesis, and then through their root structures and through fungi that live around the roots, as well as another substance that was just discovered in 1996 by USDA scientists called glomalin, which is a substance that coats the roots of the plants. There are billions of transactions that are taking place in the soil around the roots of these plants, especially grasses. Grasses are the best for this, where the carbon is then exchanged for the nutrients, and the nutrients go to the plant, and the carbon goes into the soil. And with lots of glomalin in soil, that's only present in really healthy soils, the carbon is then encapsulated and stays in the soil.
That is, as long as the soil is not being plowed, you need undisturbed subterranean environments to successfully sequester carbon. And she says that's where grasslands and grazing areas come in. Her book is meant to encourage farmers to reform their practices. So what can the consumer take from it? Buy grass-based animal products.
You know, I really encourage people to look in their communities for where they can get the dairy products and where they can get the beef, where the animals are actually on grass as much as possible. And the options are there. You often have to leave your grocery store to find it, but it's there.
Nyman admits that she's an insider. She raises cows, after all. Her book, then, is a constructive criticism of her industry. She hopes fellow ranchers will see her suggestions as a way to move forward.
Being a part of, you know, a ranch for the last decade and knowing really good ranchers around the country, I really want the beef industry to survive. And what I see happening, you know, Americans are eating 22% less beef over the last three decades. Americans are cutting down on their beef. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but my point is if the beef industry doesn't want, you know, this to continue, you know, to go down, they need to listen to the concerns of people in the environmental community and people in the health community and really make sure that the practices that are being engaged in across the industry are matching people's expectations as far as animal husbandry and as far as land stewardship and in terms of the safety and quality of the meat that's produced. People are very clearly more and more saying they don't want chemicals and drugs in their food system. That is so clear. It's so loud and clear. And the mainstream beef industry is still not getting that message. So I'm really hoping my book will be received by the beef industry as a sort of a really constructive criticism of how to go forward in a positive way.
Nicolette Hahn Nyman is a rancher, an environmental attorney, and an author. Her new book is called Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. More from my conversation with her is at eartheats.org. Coming up, one of our favorite veggies.
Today we're using a nice variety of kale. We're using the Tuscan kale, the curly kale, and the purple kale. And we're going to do a kind of a Brazilian dish.
Daniel Orr has a salad recipe for us, but just wait, this is an especially interesting treatment of a big bowl of greens.
Mulher, você vai gostar. Tô levando uns amigos pra conversar. Eles vão com uma fome que nem me contem. Eles vão com uma sede de anteontem. Salta cerveja estupidamente gelada para batalhão e vamos botar água no feijão.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. Hello, it's Earth Eats. We've heard it before. Farmers are getting older. You might think that Jerry and Paula Perrin, who are both in their 70s, are just another statistic. But what sets them apart is that they're relatively new to the game. Mark Chilla has this profile of their J&P Heritage Farm.
At Jerry and Paula Perrin's farm in Spencer, Indiana, they have amassed a menagerie of animals, including turkeys, guinea fowl, and some fin sheep. Those, though, they're raising just for the fleece.
We would have a hard time butchering them because they're so darling.
The minute we come out the door, the lambs will start moving towards us, calling us.
Meh, meh.
However, their pride and joy are their American guinea hogs. They raise these hogs for meat, yes, but there are also a number of mainstays on the farm used only for breeding. These hogs get names.
So we have Fred and Ethel and Emma.
American guinea hogs are a rare breed, different from your average commercial hog. And as Jerry and Paula have found out, these hogs are special, and not just because of their prized meat.
These guys are just very friendly. They know their names. I can call Emma, and Ethel and Fred will stay, and Emma will come.
Well, our biggest hog right now is Fred. He's our principal boar. He's the mating giant. Fred is maybe 300 pounds, but he probably won't get any bigger than
maybe
that.
Maybe 400. He is huge. He's a big boy.
Big is a relative term, though. Compared to what you'd see on your average commercial farm, American guinea hogs are actually fairly small.
They never get huge like the, I call them industrial hogs, right? You'll never see a guinea hog get to 600 to 800 pounds.
But Jerry and Paula prefer these smaller hogs, and there's a reason for that.
We just can't imagine dealing with 800 pounds of hog. We're in our 70s, and you know, you don't mess with an 800-pound hog.
Jerry and Paula, you see, are retired. Farming is something that they only took up after retirement. For most of their life, they lived in Denver, where they worked in education.
Because we love kids, we decided, well, we'll just take up animals. And we just love them, but you have to also support yourself.
What started out as more or less a hobby in retirement has grown into this small, sustainable business. They wanted to gain something more out of their farm, and that's when they became involved in the farm-to-table movement. They brought their hogs first to the attention of our very own Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington.
One day, about a year ago, we stopped in here for lunch, and I asked to talk to Chef Daniel, and when I mentioned American guinea hog, he said, when you have one that's ready for processing, call me.
It took over a year for that hog to get to the right size, which is pretty slow, but that's all part of the American guinea hog's appeal.
They mature much more slowly than the production hogs, and the end result is that they're worth the wait because their meat is red, not white, and it's just surpassingly wonderful. These guys are getting very good food, and I think that's why the flavor of the meat is more mellow, a little richer.
But raising hogs means growing that food, and they've learned quickly that it requires an extensive knowledge of what grows well on the land. The farm has been an ongoing learning experience.
Just makes me spend a lot of time thinking about how to improve the pasture, grow better grass, more nourishing grass, legumes.
J&P Heritage Farm only began to make a profit after about 3 years. As retirees, Jerry and Paula are not really interested in achieving that huge profit margin. They instead prefer to keep their operation, like their hogs, small. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
Jerry and Paula Perrin run J&P Heritage Farm. We have more profiles of farmers on our website, eartheats.org. We heard news recently that McDonald's is trying out a breakfast bowl that includes kale, along with egg whites and turkey sausage. Interesting. Chef Daniel Orr loves him some kale, and so do you, apparently. Here's a recipe for all you kale heads.
All right, so people really always want to know about kale and different ways to use it. And it stores really well, lasts in your refrigerator for quite a while. What I like to do is bring it home and then wash it really well, dry it really well, and then put it in a plastic bag with some holes in it and put it in your salad crisper, and it will last 2 to 3 weeks like that. Today we're using a nice variety of kale. We're using the Tuscan kale, the curly kale, and the purple kale. And we're going to do a kind of a Brazilian dish that they serve with feijoada, which is the national dish of Brazil. It's that real earthy black bean and pork dish where they use everything from the tail to the snout in it. They serve this accompanied to that, so because it's very light and it's a nice green vegetable, and a few orange slices. So I'm kind of combining the kale and the orange slices together to make a little salad that we call massaged kale salad. All right, so we're just going to cut this really, really thin, and that's really the most important part of this dish because you're cutting it so thin that it's going to become tender when you massage it. So it's very, very thin ribbons. Today we're going to use good olive oil, and this is the time where you pull out that expensive bottle of olive oil, you know, that $15 bottle, because you're using it raw, and that's how you're going to taste a good olive oil. Okay, we're going to add about two cups of kale. We're going to add about 2 tablespoons of olive oil, a good pinch of freshly cracked black pepper, a good pinch of kosher salt, and then I'm going to chop up some mint, and that's going to give the salad a nice lively flavor. And again, you don't need to mince it up too fine. We want to have that mint in every other bite, so not every bite tastes the same. We're going to add a little bit of lemon juice, and we're even going to take a little bit of that peel. You could take a vegetable peeler, or if you've got good knife skills, just cut a little strip off there, and we're going to do what we call a brunoise. And a brunoise is a very fine dice. When you bite into it, it releases those essential oils from the lemon, and you're really going to get these little explosions of lemon flavor. I'm going to add just a little bit of orange juice, fresh orange juice. Then you just get in there with your fingers and really work it. We're really going to massage it like it's got a big backache. And then what that does is it tenderizes it, makes it easier to eat. Okay, and you're going to massage it just for maybe about a minute. And I'm going to give it a little taste. Now, I added just a little bit of salt. Again, greens are easy to oversalt, so you always can add a little more, but you can't take it out once you put it in there. So, I think you guys are going to love this.
All right, so pick up some kale from your market this weekend and follow this recipe at eartheats.org. If you have a dynamite kale recipe, we want to know about it. Send it to us at eartheats@gmail.com. The crew who puts in work for Earth Eats includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. It's been wonderful to have you with us today. Let's do it again. Same time next week. I'm Annie Corrigan.